From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Just because you can't see a 15th century Spanish ruin does not mean it's not there.
X never, ever marks the spot.
Shining a light on South Carolina's hidden past. That's coming up. First, though, take just a couple minutes to support this show and GPB. We're in the middle of our spring fund drive. Go to gpb.org and click donate or call 800-222-4788. It's easy, it's quick, and you'll feel good all day long, maybe even the whole week. Last week, we asked the Break Room Gang if they felt safe biking around Atlanta.
I'm not good on a bicycle, so no.
Absolutely, and I do.
Absolutely, and I've been doing it for years.
Here are your first thoughts.
My name's Melissa. I'm from Augusta, Georgia. I just moved here from Minnesota for school, and this last weekend, actually, I was hit by a driver while riding my bike, and it was a pretty traumatic experience. Coming from Minnesota, where biking is relatively easy, I used to ride my bike all the time. And then moving to Georgia, where drivers don't really seem to know the laws or rules associated with biking, it's been a pretty jarring experience.
It has been jarring for me too, Melissa. Oh, we always love to get your thoughts. You can call us at 404-500-9457 like Melissa did, or find us on Twitter. It's at OST Talk. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. One approach to climate change is to slowly chip away at the things that we've been doing that have increased it until greenhouse gas emissions level out. But our next guest wants more dramatic results than that, to reverse climate change by 2050. Paul Hawken is the founder of Project Drawdown. It's a group, a large group of scientists and business leaders who have come up with 100 solutions to reverse climate change. And those solutions are the subject of Paul Hawken's new book, Drawdown. Hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, as I read, you had more than 200 scientists and researchers contributing to this book. Is that accurate?
That's correct, yes. From 22 countries, 6 continents.
That is a lot of differing opinions. What, did it make it harder to have that many chefs in the kitchen?
You know, the problem with climate, as it's reported, is it's about opinion and belief. And ours is not about opinion or belief. It's about hard science, and every single solution we mapped, modeled, and measured was backed up by peer-reviewed science. So we weren't dealing with opinion; we were trying to brush that away and get to facts.
But what measures did you take? What measure did you decide which were the most effective solutions, as opposed to all the other things that one can do?
Science. In other words, the only measure we relied upon in terms of measuring the carbon impact, and you can either do two things with respect to the atmosphere: you either stop putting greenhouse gases up there or you bring them back home through sequestration. And so every single data point on carbon was from peer-reviewed science, and not opinion, not belief, not anecdotes, not what's called internet science, which isn't science at all, but just stories. And no one had ever done this before, Celeste. No one's ever mapped, measured, and modeled the 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, whatever number of the top substantive solutions to reverse global warming. And what we want to reverse is global warming, not climate change. Climate change is always going to happen every second for infinity. That's what the atmosphere does, and that's actually a good thing. We have seasons, evolution.
Yeah, it's a natural process.
Yeah, global warming is what we want to reverse.
Which is an unnatural process. So one of the things that you say is that this is not a plan.
Right.
So what does that mean?
What it means is that in the process, actually, when the title came out, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming, that was the verso, the back of the book, that an intern from Stanford wrote at my publisher's, Penguin Random House, and my editor sent it to me, and I go, oh, no, you know, we're not a plan. I told you that. We're not a plan. We're a research institute. But I looked at it, and actually, I thought, no, it's right. The first part, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed, that's easy. No one's ever proposed a plan to reverse global warming.
Not a comprehensive one, yeah.
No, any plan. There is no plan to reverse global warming in the world. Okay, none. And it's about stabilization, reduction, mitigation, adaptation, all these words. But when you look at the data, at the science, we're at 402 ppm. Human beings have not existed here at that level.
Sorry, what is a ppm?
Parts per million, excuse me. Thanks. We tried to de-lingoize and de-jargonize in the book, but sometimes it slips out. So We have never lived here as a human, as a civilization. So at 4:02 p.m., that's 14 million years ago. We have no idea what will happen. The idea that there's stability at this level of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere is actually a fiction.
And the book is, for those listening, very readable. It's filled with beautiful pictures. And you have separated things out into here's how you reverse climate change in the energy field or food or materials, buildings and cities. Give me an example of something that we can that relates to what our everyday lives out of those, something that some person right now today could to do.
Reduce food waste. It's the number three solution. It surprised us, by the way. We were very surprised after 2.5 years of research how they ranked. And the number three solution is reducing food waste. You say, well, how could that be? Well, we waste almost 40% of our food in the United States. It never gets to our mouths. It's produced, but by the time it gets to our house or to our restaurants or wherever food is served, it is thrown away. And it takes 10 calories to produce a calorie worth of food. If it's 40% waste, that's 14 calories. And then that food is then put into landfills. And landfills,
it decomposes
and produces methane, which is 34 times more powerful than CO2. You just add it all up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you get the number three solution to reversing global warming is to reduce food waste.
So another thing that you talk about in terms of these solutions is that almost all of them lead to what's called regenerative economic outcomes.
Yes.
What does that mean?
What it means is that we've looked at these solutions in terms of just their impact on carbon. And what we don't realize is, in fact, they have cascading second and third order benefits for people in terms of health, welfare, prosperity, lower costs, more jobs. Today, for example, solar exceeds coal in terms of the number of jobs. Altogether, renewable is starting to approach coal, gas, and oil in terms of the number of jobs in the United States.
And in some cases, is actually cheaper. It's crossed the line to be cheaper than
fossil
fuels.
It has crossed the line. Wind turbines now are the cheapest or least expensive form of new electrical generation in the world.
So in the 30 seconds to a minute that we have left, you're talking about renewable energies at the same time that our president is talking about bringing back jobs in coal. How do you fight a political message?
You don't fight that at all. He's the one who's got to fight because no one's going to do it. No utility company in the United States is going to build a new coal-fired plant. He can open up every seam on every bit of BLM land in the country.
Bureau of Land Management.
Yes, Bureau of Land Management. But no utility is going to buy more coal. They're shutting them down as he's, you know, basically making promises he can't keep to coal miners. What we need to take care of our coal miners, but the way to take care of them is not by making promises you can't keep.
That's Paul Hawken, author of Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. Paul, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Just ahead, South Carolina has a secret history under the ground. First, though, just a reminder, On Second Thought is only possible because listeners like you have chosen to support programs like this. Sometimes our funding is in jeopardy. That could be the case right now, and that means we need you to step up and be the hero for public broadcasting and make it possible for everyone to have access to this level of journalism. It's quick, it is easy, and it's really, really important. Here's how you do it. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Last summer, archaeologists uncovered a 440-year-old Spanish fort on Paris Island in South Carolina. Well, not exactly uncovered. Victor Thompson is half of the team that discovered the fort. He's director of the Center for Archaeological Sciences at the University of Georgia in Athens and joins me now. Good morning, Victor.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. When I say uncovered, it's more like found, right?
Well, yes, that's correct. We recently published an article in the Journal of Archaeological Science Reports on our finding. And it's sort of not what you traditionally think of archaeologists doing, because we use a bit of high-tech equipment to image archaeological remains beneath the subsurface. So a lot of it was the research was accomplished without actually excavating.
Which is not what we usually think of with archaeologists with their little brushes and shovels. But I read that this is the only complete town from this time period, at least, in North America that was mapped entirely from above the ground. How did you know where to look?
Well, so the history of research on the site spans over a couple of decades, beginning with a couple of colleagues, Stanley South, who is at the University of South Carolina, and Chester DePrater, who's also at the University of South Carolina and who is a co-author on the study. And they've been conducting research there for quite some time, and I think Chester started in the 1990s. But so in essence, this is sort of traditional archaeology, then followed up by this sort of 21st century archaeology, where we had some ideas of where to look based on their initial work. And from that, with sort of support from the both the United States Marine Corps and the Santa Elena Foundation, we came back with a team and mapped the entire town with remote sensing equipment, ground-based remote sensing.
So you mentioned Santa Elena. That was the town, a town, city? What do we call it from that time, 440 years ago? And Fort Marcos was built right next to it. And Santa Elena, was it the capital of the Spanish settlement in the Americas at that point?
It was the capital of Spain's endeavor in what is now the United States. So really the story of Santa Elena begins with the French. The French came there in the early 1560s and set up Charles Fort. And it wasn't until 1565 that Pedro Menendez, who becomes the Adelantado, basically the governor of La Florida, comes in, drives the French out. Not they had already left Santa Elena, but there was another Fort Caroline, which is now on the was on the banks of the St. John's River in northern Florida. He comes in. He establishes St. Augustine in 1565, and Santa Elena in 1566, where the first fort at Santa Elena was built. Which was Fort San Salvador, which we don't know where that is. And then shortly after that, Fort San Felipe the First. There's a dizzying array of forts at Santa Elena.
We're not going to be able to go back over the history of Spanish settlements here. But what does this tell you? I mean, this was an important town to the Spanish at that time, which means this fort that was built to help protect it was also important. So what do you learn by mapping this from above ground?
Well, what we learn is, you know, basically how the Spanish dealt with the hardships of establishing what basically is a European town in an alien landscape, a new world. In other words, they're trying to transplant these ideas into a very unfamiliar setting, interacting with unfamiliar peoples, the Orista, which is the Native American tribe. Now, San Marcos, the fort that we discovered, was all part of this. It's part of sort of the snapshot, because in 1576, the town was sacked and burned and abandoned, and San Marcos was part of this recolonization of the town. In essence, this was almost like a prefab fort brought up from St. Augustine on boats and then established very quickly so that recolonization of that town can happen. So in essence, this provides this bit of a snapshot of how the Spanish sort of took back this landscape for at least a little while.
And it also kind of tells you, because they were having so many troubles, they lost this territory to Native Americans at that point, only to try to get it back again temporarily. Mm-hmm. But it kind of tells you that they were evolving in their approach, because this fort was not built the way they had constructed and designed other forts. It was they tried to innovate.
Right. So it was put in the middle of the settlement, which is very different from some of the other forts. It's put in the middle of the settlement, in essence, so that they could recolonize. So it was constructed basically to defend against Indian attack, Native American attack, not other European powers at the time. Now, after a while, San Marcos was then dismantled and rebuilt along the water's edge. And that's largely due to threats by the British. I mean, by the tail end of Santa Elena, you have the famed privateer Sir Francis Drake sacking and burning Spain's holdings in other areas. And that's actually part of what led to the initial abandonment, the final abandonment of Santa Elena and its consolidation to St. Augustine, which then becomes the capital.
Well, it's very fascinating. And it's Victor Thompson is director of the Center for Archaeological Sciences at UGA. His team discovered a Spanish fort buried underground for more than 400 years. Victor, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Just ahead, dogs made it big long before a keyboard. Cat did, on the internet anyway. But first, it's that time of the year when we remind you that it is your support that keeps this program and all the shows that you rely on coming from GPB. You know, Spider-Man's uncle told him, with great power comes great responsibility. Well, I just want to say a special thank you to the listeners who have the great power of supporting public radio, and they accept the great responsibility of actually donating during the Spring Fund Drive. Both of those two things go hand in hand, but it's a small number of listeners that actually step forward to take the responsibility for the power that they have. And if you're one of them, thank you. You are a hero. It only takes a minute or two. You can do your part at gpb.org or call 800-222-4788. And here are more details. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. You may not have heard William Wegman's name, but you've probably seen his dogs. His Weimaraner Man Ray became famous for his almost skeptical expression, and when he died, he was named Man of the Year by the Village Voice. A new exhibit of William Wegman's artwork is coming soon to the Telfair Museum in Savannah, and artist William Wegman joins me now via phone. Hi there.
Hello.
I read that you actually started out studying to be a painter, so why and when did that change?
Well, I sort of emerged in the 60s when all of those historical mediums were being challenged. Painting was dead. And things like video had just started to come out where, you know, you would not like on your phone like today, but relatively portable compared to TV stations. So I started to experiment with video back in the 60s, and I switched to photo from painting to document some of the things I was tossing off buildings, floating down rivers, you know, kind of performance things that I was doing. So that happened in the late 60s and, you know, started from there.
And you just got more excited about it. But what was it about Man Ray, the first Weimaraner? You must have taken thousands of photos of that dog. What was it about his personality, or I guess his expression, that started the dog photography?
Well, I think the reason why it's lasted so long is that he was gray, and gray goes with anything. So it isn't like if I had started with a Dalmatian or a Lab, it would be very doggy, but Weimaraners are kind of ethereal. Their nickname is the gray ghost, and they can emerge in various guises in my work. And Man Ray, like all hunting dogs, likes to do what I do. If I was a hunter, he'd be watching me load my gun and go off in my pickup truck to the woods and look for rabbits or birds. But instead, I went to my studio where I was trying to set up my video equipment or photo equipment, and he was very attentive to that.
So this new exhibit looks back over five decades in art.
Gosh.
that's a long time to be not just a working artist, but a successful working artist. So congratulations.
Thanks.
But one of the things it's talking about is improving, and it's even in the title, is improving artwork and imagery. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's kind of a desperate title in a way. In the mid-70s, I was fortunate or unfortunate enough to have a Guggenheim grant, and I upgraded all my equipment, which I didn't know how to use anymore. I started to take really bad photographs, and rather than throw them away, I used some of my skills as a painter, which is my real background, to kind of improve, or rather rescue them. So it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek title about not throwing anything away.
But this also focuses, this exhibit focuses on, as the Telfair describes it, the artist's hand in your artwork, and making, you know, as opposed to making it all look effortless, kind of showing the mind behind the art. Do you normally sort of steer away from things that show the craft?
Well, I don't really know how to answer that. I think it's more about, I'm sort of a busy, hands-on person. I like to do and then think rather than think and do, sort of the opposite. So I make a mark and then question why I've made the mark and then move on from there. I've always, back when I was a little boy and a painter, I would look out the window and wonder what was right beside the window, which I couldn't see. And so it would have started with looking to begin with.
So, I mean, you have done so much during your career so far, and one of the things that you have focused on is outreach to kids. The dogs have been on Sesame Street. You've written a number of children's books. How do you approach, I guess, cultivating art consumers, art lovers among children?
That's just one of those wonderful things that happened. A lovely woman who was in charge of Sesame Street's outside invitations, invited me based on knowing my video work. She thought I could do something that would be interesting to children, so I gave it a try, and it was really fun to do, and it was really kind of great to have that kind of audience.
Is that also, do you consider that to be art?
I don't not consider it to be art. I don't really consider it. I just do it and see what happens. You know, anything is art if you say it's art, and whether it's interesting or not is not up to me or the maker, but the world at large, the viewers. So that's how I approach things. I'm not sort of stuck on one type of thing.
Well, and you have such a sense of humor in a lot of your artwork, and I wonder how did you sort of strike a balance, or were you ever concerned with the balance between your sense of humor and the approachability, the accessibility of art, which isn't the best way to say that, but the popularity of your art as opposed to making sure critics take you seriously. Was that ever a concern?
I don't know about that. I know that I really wanted to be have my work looked at, and if someone looks at it and laughs, then I know at least they're getting it. If they look at it and go, huh, that's okay too. But a real direct response is something I must have craved going back to my childhood. Mom, see what I did?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the audience is my big mom, I guess, so.
Do you ever go to some of your exhibits and look at people's responses?
Well, I've got a wonderful collection of work based on my work that children have sent me. Their idea of what a dog dressed up might look like. And it's been very entertaining having that. I remember riding my bike through an area in New York and having some 18-year-old kid seeing my dogs run along with me, Sesame Street. And, and that was terrific, you know, that because that happened to this person like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But
he's,
or still 20 remembered. Years ago, but it still has an effect on them. It certainly was fun to do, and you know, it's great.
That's artist William Wegman. A new exhibit of his works goes on display at the Telfair Museum in Savannah, May 12th. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Nice talking with you.
Just ahead, our producers and people in Georgia are pretty stressed out. You can find out why in a moment. But a reminder first that one way to relieve stress is to give to public broadcasting. It makes you feel good all day. It creates a warm, fuzzy feeling inside. And it's so easy to do. You just choose the amount. You give your listening habit a value and then go to gpb.org and click donate or 800-222-4788. Here's more on how you can help. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We'd expect people in Atlanta to feel stressed considering our traffic issues here, but it is not just Atlanta. A recent study by WalletHub found the state of Georgia ranks 8th in the nation for stress. The study looked at things like how much you work, how much sleep you get, and the personal bankruptcy rate. We asked our coworkers here at GPB what is stressing them out, so relax. It's time to open the gripe bag.
I don't like things now compared to the way they used to be.
You know what really grinds my gears?
All this progress. Phooey!
Will you please tell me why?
That's the way it was and we liked it.
Get off my lawn!
I'm Josephine Bennett, Station and Community Engagement Manager at GPB Macon. As we get ready to celebrate Earth Day, my mind goes back to Iron Eyes Cody. Who's that, you ask? He's the star of the 1970 commercial featuring a crying Native American shedding a single tear over the state of the environment. The tagline is, "People start pollution, people can stop it."
Some people have a deep, abiding respect for the natural beauty that was once this country. And some people don't. People start pollution. People can stop it.
I grew up watching that ad, and it never occurs to me to throw my trash on the ground. But you know something? Litter has made a comeback. It's everywhere these days. In my downtown Macon neighborhood, it's mostly cups, beer bottles, fast food wrappers, and lots of cigarette butts. When did this become okay? Has a whole generation missed out on the message that littering is terrible? Perhaps it's time for a new guilt-inducing commercial so people can just stop it.
Hi, my name is Sean Powers. I'm a reporter and a producer for GPB's On Second Thought. Now, one of the things that bothers me the most when I'm out clubbing or out with friends is that some bartenders have this lack of knowledge about a truly Southern delicacy. If there's one cocktail you should know about, it's the Sazerac. The drink was born in 1838 in New Orleans, and some say it's the oldest cocktail in the country. Others say it's the oldest in the South. The drink includes American rye whiskey with a dash of absinthe. You can feel the flavor of generations bouncing off your tongue. When I meet a bartender who doesn't know how to make the Sazerac or isn't prepared to do so, I remind them that we are in the South.
This bar looks like it was set up by a blind man, and there's no bourbon.
And then I get up and leave to find a bar that has its act together.
Rye okay with you?
You look like you know what you're doing.
Get it together, bartenders of Georgia. This is Cocktail 101.
Hi, I'm Whitney Sheridan, director-producer of On Second Thought here at GPB. Georgia is buggy. I'm talking giant, radioactive, prehistoric-era-looking beasts. When I moved here from Pennsylvania, come on, I expected a warmer climate would definitely lead to longer insect-breeding seasons and many more creepy crawlies. What I really wasn't expecting or prepared for, moving into a completely flea-infested apartment.
That's how they get you. They're under the goddamn ground.
What the hell are they?
Sons of bitches.
Really? That happens? I also wasn't prepared to see things I can't capture with a common paper towel. Creatures I will never let my cat near because I'm afraid he will be the one that will get attacked. Not the other way around. Insects that look like they should have become extinct years ago. So from now on, here's what I've learned. Check all windowsills, hidey holes, and any dark corners, because you never know what could be lurking.
My name is Trevor Young. I'm a producer for On Second Thought. Now, this is not a new criticism of Atlanta, but man, people here have no idea what to do when there's a cyclist on the road. I shouldn't have to say the benefits of cycling are well documented. And in many places, it's a way of life. Those less car-centric cities and states are almost always happier. You would think a burgeoning city like Atlanta would get with the trend, but every day I either get honked at, yelled at, aggressively sped past, and almost killed.
Like, when I'm in my car, I have a different set of values. I am the worst person I can be when I'm behind the wheel. Which is when I'm in my most dangerous.
Listen, folks, the road belongs to everyone. Stop being so obsessed with your car. You're not better for having one. If you tried riding a bike, maybe you'd understand. Also, we just really don't want to die trying to get to work.
Hope you have a big trunk, because I'm putting my bike in it.
Hey, thanks, Atlanta. My car's currently in the shop, all because I had the audacity to attempt executing a left turn onto Roswell Road during rush hour. Trying to safely cross two lanes of speeding traffic while merging into two more lanes of speeding traffic is a life-threatening maneuver in a town that's short on common sense and is absolutely devoid of vehicular courtesy. What this enclave of benighted yahoos clearly requires is more traffic lights to cut down on the carnage because there are too many pinheads behind too many wheels around here. Put your damn phones down.
But it's my turn to drive. Driven to the margin of error.
That last gripe was from Political Rewind producer Lisa Clark. What is stressing you out? Call us and let us know at 404-500-9457. You can also post your rant to Facebook or on Twitter. We're at OST Talk. And you know what's not stressful? Supporting GPB. It's actually really easy, really quick, and it makes you feel good to know that you're helping to keep great journalism on the air and accessible to everyone. That's the end of On Second Thought for today, but take a minute or two right now to go to gpb.org or just call 800-222-4788. Do it now while you're thinking about it, and thank you so much. Here's more on how you do it.